Hi, and welcome to the Rare Business Podcast. My name is Adrian Swinsko, and I'm a consultant, advisor, researcher, and writer on all things related to customer service and customer experience. Through this podcast, I seek out and interview CEOs, entrepreneurs, business and tech leaders, and leading thinkers about what it takes to build organizations that produce better outcomes for both customers and employees in this fast-moving modern age that we live in. If this is your first time listening to one of these interviews, then welcome. And please do dive into the archives at adrianswinsko.com, as I've now completed over 250 of these interviews in the last few years. If this is not your first time listening, then thank you for returning, and I'll aim to do a good enough job to keep you coming back week after week. Anyway, that's enough from me right now. Let's get into the interview. So welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Ronnie Gottschlich, who is CEO of Hörnerdell and also former CEO of Lidl UK. Hi, Ronnie. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you very much, Adrian. I hope you're well as well.
Yeah, I'm very, very well today. So, Ronnie, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a bit about you and a bit about the work that you do?
Okay. Well, I'm currently heading an independent advisory. We've been putting together a few excellent people from different angles of the retail business, and we're trying to really help young businesses in the retail world, but as well as well-established retailers from all over Turkey to Western Europe and in the UK, Sainsbury being one of those clients, trying to help them maybe understand a little bit more where the discount idea and the discount savings could come from, but not to the detriment of customer satisfaction.
Right.
Yeah, so that's what we're doing just now. And I've been obviously working before this new business for 16 years for one of the fastest growing empires in the retail world, for the Swartz Group, and in particular the last 6 years as the CEO of Lidl UK from 2010 until 2016.
Okay. So, Ronnie, we met at the World Retail Forum in Amsterdam, where I was chairing and we were both speaking. And the thing that struck me is because you were talking and you were telling the story about Lidl, particularly Lidl in the UK. And I think what was the thing that struck me about what you were talking about in the talk is like it felt a lot like that Lidl had actually disrupted the UK supermarket market. And actually, I thought that's really interesting because actually, you know, when people talk about disruption, they normally talk about tech and software and things. But so do you think it would be fair to say that Lidl and also your German compatriot sort of Aldi, do you think they have disrupted the UK grocery market over the last few years? And actually, was that through choice or was that actually through economic circumstance?
Well, I think, yes, we would definitely have disrupted the market. Otherwise, how would you explain some of those big retailers losing some massive market share?
Sure.
And being in some serious change involved? It was probably due to them having to adjust themselves quite a bit to the British market, i.e. Lidl and Aldi had to do that for years and years and years. The discounters would have tried to adapt or not adapt their model and just put this over customers all across Europe to an extent where in some countries that worked really, really well and was good enough to take a German model, but the British customer being one of the most demanding customers in the world I've seen, and really it needed something to change for themselves. And what really the three areas were where something had to change was freshness, communication, and the Britishness. And those three things combined, and we would have tackled all three of them in a detail and in a, let's say, a different way to the traditional discount model stemming from Germany, have meant quite a change to themselves. But the result of it meant that the customers were flocking through the doors more and more and understanding more and more about what discount retail means. And it means by no means any negative or lower quality. If anything, it means everything a customer can taste, eat, feel, or see, still being British and of high quality, but very silently running in the background is a German efficiency engine.
Right. And so actually, one of the things that really, that probably really stand out for people, particularly in the UK, if they weren't regular customers at Lidl, is that you talked about the three areas. You talked about freshness, communications, and sort of Britishness. But it's the communications, I think, that's the thing that was the real sort of public face and that drastic kind of change. Can you explain kind of what you did in terms of how you almost debunked a lot of these ideas around freshness and Britishness in your advertising campaign? Because I just think it really has led the way in terms of that idea of almost like co-creating marketing with customers and also debunking a whole bunch of myths around your little niche in the market.
Well, yes, it started at first. It started to try and convince internal barriers to try and get to a more modern way and right way to communicate with the British customers, not the traditional way the German customers would have loved to see the advertising. The German way being, German people usually sit on the Sunday morning at their breakfast table and read through 10 or 15 different types of leaflet just to compare if the jar of Nutella is 5p cheaper somewhere else, and then to travel 15 miles to get that 5p cheaper glass of Nutella somewhere else, where the British customer has long ago said goodbye to those very traditional forms of media and is being rather addressed by more modern media, whether that be to television, radio, or even online advertising. Mm-hmm. So you really had to change that form. But if you were just to go and try and advertise to someone who's, let's say, skeptical about your proposition, and everyone, not everyone, but quite a few of the people just couldn't understand how you can be so cheap and still of high quality. I've heard some people sometimes saying, it must be Polish donkey meats, the discounters selling.
No disrespect to Polish donkeys meant, obviously.
No, of course, no disrespect to the Polish donkeys. This is very fine meat, and I'm sure there's some proper restaurants selling that. But it is, you got to be honest, it's quite a hurdle to get over. And I have to say, the quality aspiration of Lidl would really have been always the highest, and they would have always aimed to be at the brand, if not higher quality, into what they put in their private label product. So all of that really was difficult to get across to the customers, and you really needed to find a way how to speak to the customers with modern media, but maybe bring that across in a way that the customers would get it better. And the way to do that was to really work for the first 2 or 3 years, not with any actors, but let customers do the speaking for you. Mm-hmm. Actually film some of your customers when they were doing the shopping, and only afterwards asking, okay, can we take that recording and make sure we show that and your reaction. The results were phenomenal. The people were surprised when they were visiting some stand-up farmers markets in East London, where people just went to shop in a one-day built-up farmers market for all the products to be on that farmers market to be from Lidl, just for everyone thinking, they must come from the farm, etc. When they realized what they were charged for the product, they were just all gobsmacked because it was so cheap.
Yeah.
But really linking quality and price was the thing to do, because historically Lidl would have also just gone and communicate price and price and price. And I think there's no question Aldi and Lidl are the first place when it comes to their price recognition. But I think they both had quite a bit of work to do to overcome the hurdle of their quality perception.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's actually, so I think I remember the examples that, the stand-up or the pop-up farmers market, which was all done for like a very traditional sort of farmers market, and people came and tried lots of different, whether it's in cheeses or fruit and veg and things, and then were charged a price. We went, oh, that's cheap, and they went, oh yeah, and then everything was put in a Lidl bag, and so that was really, really clever. But then it also went further where you had these adverts where people were obviously skeptics about how you'd source some of this the foodstuffs. I was particularly interested in the I particularly liked some of the fishery ones, because it's all based up in Scotland, obviously.
Of course. Yes.
And but actually, that my question would be is like, how did you source those people, the skeptics around the sourcing of it? I mean, you say it's real people, it's not actors. I mean, was it just done from social media, or did you ask for volunteers, or how does that work?
No. You couldn't have asked for volunteers, because then you would have staged it, right?
Yeah.
So you obviously have your Twitter channels, your Facebook channels open all the time, and by no means everything which comes back is positive, that everyone just sings praises. There are some skeptical people about your business. They'll be there all the time. There will be feedback which isn't nice, because certain things have not worked in stores. But in the instance you've described with some Scottish farmers or some Scottish fishermen, we've had some ladies or some men who, let's say, were really skeptical about thinking, okay, well, that fish must come, God knows where from, must be a very low quality, it cannot be any good. Same about the meat. And what we've just done is we've taken our social team and asked to get in contact with those people to try and build a case, and invited them, well, why don't you come for one day out with us on the farm where the products are being produced, get on the ship and see where the mussels come from. And the people have made the journey, and just from the morning, a farmer's day starts very early at 5 o'clock. The lady, I remember, needed to get up very, very early, and I was in the farm when we were doing the filming as well. So the people said yes to being filmed when they had their experience day of a farm in Scotland. They were just from step by step seeing the cow on the field, or seeing the fisherman's boat getting out on the ocean. That to see it's real life. It's Scottish. It's probably one of the best British environments to harvest.
Sure.
Not just that I have to say that for you as a
Scottish. No, not at all. Not at all.
Really believe that, and. Through the whole day, they've acknowledged and experienced really where the products were coming from, and also had actually the feedback that those people working with the discounter were quite positive in terms of the standards which were set about the animals, etc., in the work together, how simple it was working with the discounter. And at the end, I'm pretty sure were turned to become a loyal customer of the customer. And if that journey was resonating with that one individual and was a true story, not just anything made up with an actor, that resonated with the customers really, really well, and created the trust in those key brands, in the fresh brands. And obviously for everyone, we always knew that if people start trusting those fresh categories, in particular fresh meat, then people would shop. When they shop meat fresh with us, with Lidl at the time, they shop about 6 times more with you over the year than people who don't trust to buy that category from you.
Sure. I mean, and it's all played out. I mean, recent figures, which I thought was actually quite funny, were, I think it was one of the big supermarket chains, I think it was Tesco's, recently announced to great cheer that they'd returned to growth, but they were celebrating something between a 2% and 3% kind of like-for-like growth rate. It was a little article. Then it said, meanwhile, Aldi and Lidl have posted 12 and 13% kind of growth respectively across the same kind of time period. So, I mean, yes, they're working off a probably a slightly bigger installed kind of base, but you guys are still kind of, it's what you're doing is still resonating kind of with the market. But I think the thing I was thinking about, because you talked about the German experience and German behavior, and given the UK Lidl in the UK has been so successful, I mean, has that experience been exported to other parts of the Lidl's operations and that those kind of learnings, so that Lidl in the UK, I mean, and your experience, is it starting to transform or make the broader empire sort of think differently?
I definitely think so. Now, this is obviously, it goes, the advantage a Swatch Group and an Aldi will have is they operate in many more countries than any of the British retailers are working in. So they'll have the experience from very, very different angles. And, you know, the CEOs and the organizations would keep talking to each other of what is a current trend in a certain market. I would have taken at my time as CEO of Lidl UK some experience from my Irish colleagues into how often and in which way they were selling fresh flowers to a much larger scale.
Yeah.
And over 3 or 4 years, we've managed to actually catch up with our colleagues to grow that category from historically only twice a week allocated flowers for men and women to be lucky if flowers were available, not on the day when you wanted it to be, but on the day Lidl wanted you to be in the store,
okay.
to change that over. So, and this experience, for example, we've taken from Ireland, but then our experience, for example, with the fresh meat categories, how we branded it, how we advertised, how we went about, went into many other countries. And so this is a continued improvement which happens, and the organization is pretty fast to compare which country is best or best in practice, but not in a way anymore to say, oh, you need to do this exactly the way the British colleagues have done and adapt this to, for example, the Italian market, but take the learnings and see what is right for your market. And that's really changed for the discounters. I think that they learned the adaptation to the individual market is key to make it a success. If you were just to take the example from the UK and trying to put this one-on-one onto the Italians, I'm pretty sure we all know what's going to come out at the end of it. So yes is the answer, but in an adapted way.
Okay. And so the other thing I was kind of thinking about as well is, and this is, I had two sort of big questions. One, after we talked in Amsterdam, and one is this idea around sort of disruption and debunking customer myths and beliefs, and almost co-creating your communications with your customers to generate more trust and belief and connection. But then the other thing about it, and it's something I was talking about in my presentation, is about this idea of, you talked about efficiency, but I was talking about sort of the simplicity in business. And in my presentation, I was talking about this, there's an agency called Siegel & Gale, and they've been studying simplicity in business since, I think it's 2009, and how businesses that are categorized as being simple in how they operate and their essence and things, completely outperform any other business on whether it's customer, employee, and or financial kind of metrics. But the interesting thing is that Lidl was cited as a leader in their scales when it comes to simplicity. So the thing I wanted to actually ask and understand is that, is simplicity a core value of Lidl's? And, you know, just to... And is that by design or by just learning and choice? Or by chance, rather?
I think it is, the answer is yes, it's actually a fundamental cornerstone of the business. So simplicity is what is always tried to be kept in mind now, but be not be mistaken, you'll always be in danger of trying to add new things. If the example were to be, you want to introduce more flower range, this will drive more complexity for your people on the shop floor. But I think what the DNA of the discounters really strengthens is and makes it that strong is that they have as part of their DNA to review their processes again and again and again. And if they just were to shave off 1 second, they would amend the procedure just because they know how much they are going to save over months and years with those savings. And if everyone has got that in mind, if everyone on the shop floor, where your largest chunk of the workers are based,
sure,
then if everyone's got in mind to never work away empty-handed or unproductive, mm-hmm, to always ask themselves, if I go in that direction, is there anything else I can do at the same time?
Right.
Then this becomes part of the DNA. And let me tell you, this doesn't stop anymore at work. This goes all the way to your private household, and you go on the nerves to your partners, because you just keep asking everyone, well, couldn't you have just done that way in a more productive way and just brought that same thing down with you, take that up with you? Lidl just and Aldi just really, really have that. And they just make everyone working that little bit faster, but not that the people have to run at a much higher speed, but just everyone will rather always have a target and will know what to do instead of not having a target or a too low target, and then obviously the whole organization slows down, and they really built this in their business case. And obviously this is the biggest area for their saving and where they can invest that money saved back in the price.
And so is it all about eliminating waste or lack of efficiency, or is it also looking for better ways to do things? I mean, how does that work from an organizational perspective? I mean, is that driven from the shop floor, as it were, or is it management, or is it a combination of the two? Because that's the interesting thing, because it's easy to talk about this stuff, right?
Yeah.
But it's actually really hard to do it and do it really well.
It is both ways, first of all, because the people on the shop floor probably will pick up quickest if you launch some rubbish procedure. So,
right.
And you should never get too distant from them, because if you're launching procedures, and let's not be mistaken, that still happens, that Lidl and or Aldi launch some procedures to realize half a year later that was utter nonsense. But they will pick that up pretty quick, because the feedback will come to say, look, we are now spending 10 minutes on something which has taken us previously 5 minutes.
Right.
Because the people are driven to drive efficiency and productivity. And it is a mixture of doing things better, but it is also a thing of leaving things away. So
right.
It is the small example of asking a customer for change, or being always well equipped enough with your checkout drawer to have enough change yourself, because it's proven that if you have enough change in your drawer, that you'll be able to much, much quicker give the change back to the customer than the time it takes the customer to find the change, or worst case, sometimes find the change but the last two pennies are missing.
Right. I see. That's fascinating. And how is that? I know you say that you kind of keep trialing kind of things. I mean, I guess, is that just something that's just built into the culture of the way you do things, or are people also rewarded for, incentivized for this type of behavior? Or is it just is it just something that happens because it's the nature of the little kind of culture?
That is really just part of their nature, and there isn't any scheme in place or who's proposed the best saving. And if you propose a saving of 10 minutes, you get 1 month salary or something.
It's, right.
The organization is driven through and through for all the ranks, especially in sales, to be efficient, and people have an intention to save times because they obviously we'll always look at what could be done better, and this isn't in connection with any benefit scheme or anything. It's just that the organization sets people up, equips people, and educates people to think that way.
I mean, that's great to hear, because actually, you know, there's, you know, what it does do is it kind of puts a cross in the box that says, "Oh, I need to pay for this behavior." Actually, it's what it's saying is actually, if you get the right sort of culture and the right sort of values and the right sort of focus in place, and then hire the right people, then, and they understand what it's going to do, then it's actually not about the rewards. It's like this stuff just happens.
Yes.
Which is great. So let's kind of change, you know, so if I said to you, were Lidl actually paying attention to other sort of brands, retail brands, that, you know, and were they learning from them and watching them and being inspired with them? Or is it that you guys are just kind of out on your own doing your own thing? Or, you know, how,
I think they would definitely look all the time. I think it'd be serious trouble if you get onto something and you don't look left and right. And let's be honest, you know, there are things, others were faster than us at my time at Lidl and before and after. And you'd be even stupid, I think, if you were trying to always reinvent the wheel yourselves.
Sure.
So you sometimes just take and copy. You don't have to develop all the new products in the world yourself. You don't have to have the R&D department, the largest R&D department in the world. You sometimes may want to see from other retailers which products do sell well, and then you take them into your assortment as well. So the answer is you definitely must look. And every time I was out and about in stores, you always look at your competitors. In the UK, this is the discount competitor, but for sure the big four supermarkets and even the small convenience chains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so if we've got some executives or some entrepreneurs, you know, leaders listen to this interview, and particularly if they're struggling to achieve simplicity in their business, because it's a constant battle, as you've said, is that we have this natural tendency to add. It's easier to add more than it is to take away. I mean, what advice would you give to them to try to make their own business more simple? Where should they start? What should they do first?
Obviously, I would look at simplification where I have the highest leverage. So I would look at the shop floor stuff, usually if it was to be a grocery retailer, where, if you save 10% at 2% of your workforce, it's not going to have a big impact, but your mm-hmm. biggest workforce is usually in your warehouses and your stores. And take a look there. From my point of view, it'd be the shop floor, mm-hmm. and really take a deep dive in the operation. But don't just look at, when the store opens, look at it from the moment the products maybe arrive, at what times they arrive, how they arrive. Because quite often these things will have an effect of how many people you have and how long it'll take them to work certain things on the shop floor, how much work is involved apart from serving customers and making sure that the shop floor looks nice with administrative things, and how much you can take away. So that really, you have someone in a store mainly for the reason that the shelves are stocked. Mm-hmm. And you have good customer service. Those are the two key things I feel are necessary. And if you realize that more and more work gets absorbed, or more and more time gets absorbed by other things where people spend time in offices, mm-hmm. then this is something Aldi and Lidl would be very, very keen on, to make sure this time is very, very minimal on the customer interaction and or time on the shop floor in the majority.
I think this, you make a great point. I mean, I think this idea that simplicity can't be achieved by eliminating lines from a spreadsheet. Actually, you've got to go out and kind of really understand where the work is done, or actually where the real value is created. And it sort of reminds me of an old thing that I kind of wrote about a little while ago, but it's an old concept. It comes from Taichi Ono of Toyota, back in the day, where he talked about going to the Gemba, and the idea about going to the place where the real value is created. So this idea of not getting stuck in the office and actually being out in stores and actually understanding how things work, because that's where the real simplicity happens, where the real savings happen, or where the real efficiencies get created. So, I mean, it's a great point.
No, I think the point will be, you know, how often do you still spend a day and not just sitting in a canteen of a store,
sure.
but really working with your store managers, speaking with the people who work at delivery, and realize How far do they have to drag the pallet through the store and work it? How is the cashier process? You're sitting next to a cashier, or you're actually trying for a day as the CEO to be a cashier yourselves. Not just 5 minutes, someone shows you the checkout, but really trying to do the job.
Yeah.
You pick so many things up, which maybe are just routine for your employees, and they just fed up with it and they just do it for you to be able to change the things and take things away. And this goes through the whole organization. Now, you will find it difficult to do that for all the parts of your business. But again, if you prioritize where you have the largest part of your workforce allocated and spend some time there, you will be much, much quicker be able to save some time and energy on those kind of things. And if you do that with your board, we've done that once a year for everyone to spend a day in a store. And sometimes then together, you sometimes realize what bullshit you produced in certain procedures. And quite quickly, you felt ashamed. The good thing is, you're able to take it back and well, put something easy out. And if you are a person who the people feel they can speak to, at least when you're in the store, you get that feedback straight in the face.
Sure. No, I think that's brilliant. I mean, I think I'm a great advocate for more people actually, as you say, spending time in their businesses, particularly their distributed businesses, and not in the canteen, but actually standing alongside or actually doing the work with people, because the you know, the amount of insight that you can get, and actually, it's not just about the how much you'll learn, but it's also about these other effects, which is the amount of respect you'll generate if you do it in a humble and respectful way from the people around you. It's extraordinary, but yet we don't see very many people or many firms or many leaders do as much of that as I would like to see, at least.
Well, you're just ending up creating this ivory tower scenario, and usually in quite a few businesses, you hear, "Oh, yeah, this is the headquarter, and this is the stores, and the battle starts there, where the two fight against each other." And if they feel really more and more disconnected, the people in the shop floor feel what's being produced and being asked for from headquarters is nonsense or unrealistic, then you know, you have an internal battle rather than people being able to concentrate on customer service. And that's got to be key, same as for a discount, as for one of those big four retailers, to try and spend valuable time with your customers and adding value there. Mm-hmm. So some retailers obviously calling their headquarters customer service center. I think that's the right mindset. It will always be the question, how much of that is then internally delivered? Mm-hmm. But you know, we've had those battles as well, and I'm far away from saying that this was all taken away just by those individual actions. But you can also overcome some of those hurdles if you do manage to bring in again and again, on almost a rolling model, mm-hmm. People from the shop floor, from the active roles, bring them into headquarters for a period of 2 or 3 years, so that those people who've been up until now doing the job themselves are now responsible for creating procedures and improvements.
Sure.
And then they get back out again and live with the procedures they've launched. And you're making sure you get much more buying from the sales and the warehouse side if you were to do it this way.
Sure. That's perfect. So, Ronnie, is there anything, I mean, I'm just conscious of time, but is there anything else you'd like to add that we've missed out before I ask you my final question?
I think the grocery side isn't, grocery retail isn't difficult because it's such a technical item, and you're creating a rocket which needs to fly to the moon, right? So mm-hmm. You don't need to be a technical expert to understand what happens there. The difficulty in retail is that there are so many things happening at the same time, and you're really much better off if you can share a large amount of knowledge across more shoulders, because the people will just be better equipped to do a better job. If you just know as a CEO, oh, that's the most productive way of how to work a pallet, that's nice to know. Mm-hmm. But if you manage to get that knowledge in a simple way across to 19,000 employees, you have a much better result for your business. To get this done on many, many jobs a day is a challenge, and you've got to set yourselves up. You've got to have the DNA of it. And I think then really your business will be running more efficiently. And I think you'll be able to invest quite a bit of that back into whether price or customer service.
Yeah, perfect. So that brings me to my final question, Ronnie. And it's a question that I always ask at the end of these interviews, and I now have done more than 260 of them, no less. And the question is this: is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
Here's my shameless plug. I think everyone should support the idea of Germany becoming world champion again in football this year. That's a good idea for the English listeners. Penalty shootout or something like that. We'll see.
Well, you know what? That's gonna get up a lot of people's nose. That's fine. I'm gonna leave that with this. But what I'm going to do on the back of that is I'm gonna say to people, you know what? I learned a lot from yourself, Ronnie, when you talked at the conference. Yep. I think that you've got a wealth of knowledge and experience, and I would say that if anybody wants to learn more about, you know, driving simplicity into their business and disrupting their markets, particularly in the retail sector, then they should check out Hunadel, which is HEUNADEL.com, and all your contact details are there, and just kind of check you out. Because, I mean, one thing, you're a lovely guy, but you've got a wealth of knowledge. You're also quite controversial, but you also love the Scots.
Exactly.
And so that's my plug for you, Ronnie. You've plugged the German football team in the World Cup, which is...
There we go.
That's fine. I've plugged you. Just let me kind of say that it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Same here, Adrian.
And thank you very much for your time and the interest. And I'll make sure I get all that linked up and edited up, and we'll give you a big kind of shout out, and I'll leave you to do the final sort of like cheer for Germany in the World Cup, because that's not really down to me.
I'll do my best, then. Yeah. Adrian, thank you very much for the time today, and I hope to see you soon at one of the next venues. Yeah,
perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Well, that's it for another interview. I really hope you enjoyed it. Now, every time I complete one of these interviews, I learn something new, and I try and incorporate that new learning into my writing, my speaking, my workshops, and the consulting that I do for my clients. If you're interested, you can find out more about how I work with clients over at adrianswimsko.com. But one final thing before I go, please consider heading over to iTunes or whichever podcast platform you choose to use, and do leave a review. Every little helps, as they say. Anyway, that's all for now. Thank you for listening, and do listen in again. All the very best.